to examine what certain countries are accusing China of and what their political agenda is. Undoubtedly, this is a very significant moment for China. Its capital, Beijing, is now the world's first dual Olympic city, meaning it has hosted both the Summer and Winter Olympics. And naturally, China views that as a very special thing. It's a very prestigious status for China. Now, of course, the West doesn't see it that way. The West is outraged. Western countries have been attacking China and its Beijing Olympics since before they even started. Already several months prior, the United States just came out and announced that it would be boycotting the Beijing Olympics. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki confirmed the boycott on December 6, 2021.
The Biden administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics and Paralympic Games, given the PRC's ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses.
And of course, whenever the U.S. says, jump, its minions ask, how high? After the White House announced its boycott of the Beijing Olympics, the United Kingdom did the same.
As I've said before, we do not support sporting boycotts, but there are no plans for ministers, to attend the Winter Olympics.
So did Canada.
We are extremely concerned by the repeated human rights violations by the Chinese government. That is why we are announcing today that we will not be sending any diplomatic representation to the Beijing Olympic or Paralympic Games this winter.
And so did Australia.
The Australian government will not be sending any official representatives to the forthcoming Winter Games.
So why is the United States, why are the U.S. and its allies boycotting the Beijing Winter Olympics? Well, the official narrative is that they're protesting China's human rights abuses. They claim that China is committing gross human rights violations in Tibet, Hong Kong, and cracking down on Muslims, specifically Uyghurs and other Muslim groups in the Xinjiang province. During the opening ceremony at the so-called Bird's Nest National Stadium, the final Olympic torchbearer was Zhao Jiawen, who is a Uyghur Muslim. Essentially, what China was doing is saying, look, we don't have a problem with Uyghurs or Muslims. We have a problem with separatism. We don't discriminate, so here's a Uyghur athlete, a Uyghur Olympian, opening up the Winter Games. Now, the Western media, of course, were not impressed and didn't waste the opportunity to attack China, claiming that China was using this Uyghur athlete as a token and that the entire thing was done cynically. Danny Haifong joins me now. He's an author, political commentator, and contributing editor at Black Agenda Report. Danny is also the co-host of the YouTube show The Left Lens and co-editor of Friends of Socialist China, a platform that promotes understanding of Chinese socialism. Danny, thanks so much for taking the time. It's really great to have you on.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's always good to be with you.
Likewise, brother. I wanted to start out with the Beijing Winter Olympics that have just kicked off. In the news, we don't hear so much about the sports. We hear more about the games being boycotted by the United States, the United Kingdom, and co. I've heard people in the United States refer to them as the genocide games. Can I just get your thoughts in general on this whole debacle?
Well, I watched the opening ceremony February 4th. I was up early. I was watching it through NBC News streaming service. And it was just absolutely deplorable. I mean, the level of propaganda that China has been targeted with by the corporate media is astounding. And this has been going on for years. But the corporate media, the military-industrial complex, and these humanitarian interventionists in both camps as well as the political establishment have all coalesced around this human rights narrative to attempt to delegitimize China in this momentous occasion. I mean, it's historic that China is the first dual Olympics country. Beijing is the first dual Olympic city. Many of the facilities are being reused from the 2008 Summer Olympics. It's 100% green powered. And the COVID-19 success that China has had in containing the virus is being implemented to protect both athletes, all the participants, all of the workers, as well as the Chinese people, because this is a huge international event. And when you have a highly contagious pandemic still spreading, China has taken it very seriously. And that has become also the target of attack by the media, by the establishment. And so really, it's a full frontal assault.
Why all this propaganda? What are they trying to accomplish here? Because there is a lot of prestige associated with, as you said, being the first country to host, you know, both Olympics, the first city. So, I mean, what is the root of all this? Why all this propaganda? Why all the vitriol?
Well, I think first and foremost, the vitriol towards China is about the U.S.'s overall geopolitical strategy in the West. The junior partners that the United States has curried favor with because of very common, similar common interests, imperialism, capitalism, exploitation. This is where the West and the United States, Israel, and all of the allies that the U.S. has been able to obtain, that's where they all can agree upon. And oftentimes, it's not an equal relationship either. It's the U.S. attempting to bully them into really towing the line on the agenda, and the U.S. claims and desires to be a permanent hegemon, a permanent imperial power that has no rival. And so at the most basic level, the United States views China as a legitimate rival, but it's not enough to look at it in that lens, because that can lead to this false equivalency that unfortunately some of our friends on the left make, which is that China is just some equal imperialist power, that actually it's going far beyond what the United States can do. There's a lot of this misinformation that goes around. And so it's important to understand that the United States, if China was indeed an imperialist power, a colonial power, it wouldn't really have a problem with that. It would actually probably be seeking much closer relations to China than it ever even had during the normalization period and during the so-called, entrance into the World Trade Organization. Not even that is enough to prove that China and the U.S. were some kind of similar entities. How the United States deals with its so-called allies is through organizing them and enforcing a common agenda that China has never really been a part of, because China is led by a communist party. China has 1.4 billion non-white people. It is a country that proudly espouses socialism, and it is one that really employs a different model of international relations, one that is respective of international law. I mean, that's really at the basic level how China behaves around the world. But then you add in the fact that China's economic model is not just a rival and not just set to surpass the United States in size, but it also is setting a different kind of agenda.
Now, China opened up the Olympic Games with a Uyghur athlete, and that was met with criticism. Do you believe that that was a cynical gesture by China or a genuine gesture? And you know, what if the Olympics had not been opened up by a Uyghur athlete? They would probably still complain about that anyway, right?
It was a really beautiful display that China presented in the opening ceremony as well, was the passing of the national flag among representatives of the 56 ethnic groups. And they were passing the flag, and then it was taken by representatives of the national military. And, you know, there was that. I mean, that was a scene. Like, that was incredible. And it's in response to this. I mean, we can't deny that it's a total response to the fact that the United States and the West have propagandized around this issue for years now, first with concentration camps, then with genocide. And there's no escaping it. So, of course, I think China is totally correct in responding, especially responding in this kind of way, a very professional manner, one that definitely sends a message to Western audiences that China does not adhere to that narrative. China does not believe in that narrative, and that the Chinese people don't believe in that narrative, because the cheers were very loud during that part of the ceremony. And so it's just important to understand that that Uyghur genocide narrative was always dubious. I mean, we can go over the sources probably for hours and hours, from Adrian Zenz, Victims of Communism Foundation, all the way to the Atlantic Council, and all of the institutions and proxies for these institutions that have been rolled out, Radio Free Asia, Conduit of the CIA, I mean, on and on and on. These institutions have repeated this lie over and over and over again, and just basic data it disproves it. And so it's really an agenda. It's about targeting Xinjiang. It's about splitting China apart. It's a losing mission, and it's already lost because China is more united than ever. And a lot of it is because of this propaganda war, because ordinary Uyghurs, anyone in China doesn't want the country to be split apart. It doesn't want separatism to be fueled. It doesn't want economic livelihoods to be threatened. So the more that China is attacked by the U.S., the more unified the country becomes. And that's just one of the, I guess, benefits of this, silver linings, I guess, of the U.S.'s failed strategy.
You wrote about Eileen Gu. She's a world. You wrote about Eileen Gu. She's a world class athlete, half American, half Chinese, and she announced in 2019 that she will be representing China in 2022. And you wrote in your article that, quote, Gu has been labeled an ungrateful traitor to the United States for supposedly spurning the opportunities offered to her in the land of the free. I mean, the responses on Fox, where they were saying that she's switched sides and she's turned her back on the United States, you know, the country that raised her and provided her with training and facilities that only the U.S. has. I mean, what does that even mean? Like, other countries don't have anyone who can ski? What do you think of all this?
Essentially, it is a byproduct of a long history of racism toward Chinese, but just in general, right? This racism, this imperialism that the United States has developed over the course of its development is par for the course in reproducing the exploitation that is inherent to the U.S. way of life. And so those who cross the boundaries of what I call political whiteness, which is a tool of imperialism, this idea that you will have solidarity with the so-called enemy other, the country that has been targeted for elimination, destruction, regime change, whatever, that this is akin to renouncing your citizenship. That's what Tucker Carlson called it. And that's what many people are saying. When in fact, Eileen Gu, if you just listen to her words, it's pretty clear. Listen to her words and understand who she is. It's pretty clear that her relationship to China is very deep. It's not that she is doing this for political reasons. She's doing this because, one, she's a citizen of China. Two, her mother is very deeply involved in China's economy. She goes to China nearly every summer before the pandemic. And she has many Chinese sponsors. She's well known in China. And she's making it very clear the more and more pressers she does, because the question is asked over and over again, why'd you do this? Why'd you choose that? What do you think of what people are saying? She was very clear recently, after she won her first gold medal, that she's receiving love. And I don't think people understand that there's a good reason why she chose China over the United States. And I think we're seeing that play out. She is Chinese and she loves China. She loves the Chinese people and she has affinity towards them. They have affinity towards her. She broke the internet after she won the gold medal in China. Weibo shut down because of how many people were sharing and celebrating her victory. And so that's the kind of love she receives. You follow her Instagram, you see every post she's, you know, being mobbed by people, and she's sharing all of the heartfelt messages she's getting from people. And the United States is trying to politicize that because they see it as a smack in the face. The ruling class sees a smack in the face. And a lot of people who have digested this anti-China racism and resentment, they see it as a slap in the face. They see it as an attack on the U.S. itself, on American exceptionalism itself.
It's frankly quite incredible. You know, I know Fox News likes to paint itself as sort of anti-war, but it's really just fueling, you know, this resentment, which, I mean, what good does that do anyone? I think it's very embarrassing, as you just put it. It's really, you know, really telling on yourself by doing that. But I mean, what is this kind of reaction to Eileen Gu tell you about this anti-Chinese racism? Because, you know, this whole hashtag that we saw, like, stop a hate against Chinese, but yet there's always antagonism towards China. Like, that doesn't stop, you know? And we've also heard these other myths that, oh, careful going to the Olympics because the Chinese are spying on the athletes, like, you know, as if the NSA hasn't been bugging everyone's phone on the planet. And then, of course, you know, they were also saying how Peng Shui, this tennis player, had gone missing. Can you clue us in on all of this?
Well, it's more propaganda, and there's just been, and it's just been an onslaught, right? I mean, Peng Shui, she was unfortunately exploited by the media, the Western media, for a post that she made about a former Chinese official, former vice premier, Jiang Guoli, who supposedly was accused of sexual assault, but really it sounded like a complex situation, and certainly there may be things to investigate there. But the problem with it was that it was mistranslated, it was taken into account, and then there was a rumor that she was missing altogether, and that China had somehow detained her or disappeared her, and all of that wasn't true, right? Within a day of that accusation, photos of her on WeChat, video of her at a Beijing, you know, teenage skating competition, like they started to emerge, and the agenda is pretty clear here. And she came, and she's come up in the Olympics as well, right? Eileen Gu was asked a question about Peng Shuai, and Eileen Gu was like, "I'm happy that she's here and that she's safe," and that's all she said, because she didn't want to get into the politics of it. Because there's a lot of politics in this. The United States, if you just look at the corporate media coverage, it's not just Peng Shuai, it's everything.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
I think it's obvious to anyone who's paying attention that every single accusation made by the United States, every charge leveled against China, is hypocrisy of the highest order. You want to talk about genocide against Muslims? Sure, let's talk about genocide against Muslims. Who bombed Afghanistan? Who bombed Iraq? Who bombed Syria? Who bombed Libya? Who bombed Yemen? Who bombed Somalia? Who bombed Pakistan? Who attacked Iran? The United States literally destroys half the Middle East, half West Asia, and then they have the nerve to talk about Muslims? You have the nerve to pretend you care about Muslims? I mean, this is an insult. You know, let's talk about locking up Muslims in camps. The United States has a torture camp, Guantanamo Bay, that is reserved solely for Muslim men that have been kidnapped around the world, rendered, and kept there for years and years and years without charge, without trial. A few months ago on this program, I spoke to Mansour al-Dayfi, who was kept in Guantanamo Bay for 14 years, no charge, no trial. Here, listen to what he has to say about how much respect the Americans have for Muslims.
They used to take the Holy Quran, put it under feet, pee on it, throw what? It in the ground. Yeah, the interrogators, yes. Stopping us from praying, mocking us. I remember when I used to pray, they would throw us the Israeli flag or the American flag. Sometimes there was, like, we call it the satanic room, where they have a room, and dark room, where they put candles, and therefore there's like satanic stars and signs.
What?
It is crazy. I told you, Guantanamo was an experimenting lab.
Okay, so what does all of this mean? Does this mean that China is perfect and everything it does is perfect? Absolutely not. No country is perfect. But this is some staggering, blistering hypocrisy. And then, of course, some people will say, well, you know, two things can be bad at once. Yeah, sure, the problem is the media that are constantly attacking China and calling China out never call out the United States. And more importantly, the crimes perpetuated by the United States are systemic and on an unimaginable global scale. The United States doesn't just attack Muslims at home in the US, it literally goes around the globe invading Muslim countries and slaughtering Muslims in the street, in the market, in their bedrooms. It's not even comparable. And you know, you hear a lot nowadays about China's human rights record in the media. Well, let me jog your memory. You see, it's not that long ago that the US enjoyed a somewhat good relationship with China. Hillary Clinton, who was then the Secretary of State, actually went to China in 2008. And she was singing a very different tune compared to what you hear now.
Driving on the Third Ring Road in Beijing, I felt like I was watching a movie in fast forward. From a few high-rise buildings on my last trip to a gleaming Olympic complex and corporate skyscrapers today. We welcome China's role in promoting peace and stability in the Asian Pacific. Over the past 30 years, the United States has helped to foster security in the region, and that has been a critical factor in China's growth and an important strategic interest of our own.
I didn't hear Hillary Clinton complaining about Tibet. After all, Tibet is not an issue that just started yesterday or with the Beijing Olympics. So how come no one was mentioning it back then? I guess those human rights issues weren't so important back then, were they? And there was nothing about Uyghurs, there was nothing about Hong Kong. How weird. You see, the problem is that most people, especially Westerners, don't understand the geopolitical games being played by their governments. Let me spell this out as simply as I can. The West does not care about Muslims. The West does not care about Uyghurs. The West does not care about Kurds. Uncle Sam doesn't care about anyone. As soon as the United States is done using someone for political gain, they drop them like a hot potato. So now you see, all of these claims that the US and its allies level against China are not only dubious, but extremely hypocritical. And this bitterness, this jealousy that's expressed in the form of Olympics coverage, it's all part of America's new Cold War on China. The US is crumbling from within while China succeeds. And that breeds jealousy, hatred, and war because the US feels threatened by an alternative model. You see, when China was playing ball and not so much of a rising power, that was fine. But now that China is a real contender and set to overtake the United States to become the world's largest economy, now it's a different story. The United States does not like competition. It does not like that China's system makes its system look obsolete. And it doesn't want the world shifting from US hegemony to a multipolar system. The United States is crumbling, literally. The infrastructure is falling apart. There's a homelessness crisis, wealth inequality, racial inequality. And meanwhile, China is busy linking up its country with high-speed rail and lifting millions of people out of poverty. And the world sees this and knows. And that's precisely why over 120 countries have signed up to join China's Belt and Road Initiative, because they know that is where the future lies. It doesn't lie in some archaic, capitalist, greedy imperialist system that spawns nothing but conflict and destruction. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
کسی رو مسخره میکنیم اسمشو میذاریم شادی.
Unfortunately, making fun of others has become a means for laugh and happiness in societies. Also, some people dishonor or defame others and call them by specific names or titles. This action is absolutely prohibited in Islam. This is worse in cases where a person has a physical problem or deformation. Making fun of these people for the sake of pleasure is haram in Islam. For instance, we have some people who stammer and talk or are crippled when bored. Imitating such people and laughing at them has severe consequences for the doers. Such type of misbehavior can be initialized in a society through mockery or making fun. We are not allowed to make fun of others in our comedy shows or TV series or on social media. Ethical points have to be observed in all levels of a society and for all the people. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. As always, I have the honor and pleasure of being joined by my darling sister and special guest, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, my dear?
I'm very good, thank you. On the previous episodes of Muslim Lady, we've been talking about the expectation of a Muslim society, of a Muslim lady. And then the conclusion that we came to was that really, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter who expects what of whom, as long as we expect ourselves to just please God. And we only expect God's satisfaction. And that can only occur through strengthening and nourishing our iman. Otherwise, everything else is just pointless, really. And Sister Razia, you pointed out that a big issue, an impediment that we face, especially today, though I feel that this has always been the case, since Qabil and Habil, materialism was the problem.
Exactly.
You know?
The material world.
Exactly. He bloody killed his brother because of it. But
this
then
the Quran
changed form.
Continuously just says, Al-mal wal-banun, zinatul hayat al-dunya. Be careful so that the glitters of this world will not, you know,
distract you, blind
exactly.
you,
you're totally right. We have been built. We have been designed in a way.
We have. That's why
our
it's
eyes,
not
ching,
easy.
Ching, when you see the dollar,
we're drawn toward it, like yeah. moth towards fire. That's how we've been designed. That's why it's not easy. Mm-hmm. And that's how it's meant to be. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said that you are ashraf al-makhluqat. You're higher than my angels. You're higher than all that I've ever created. Because you've been wired to want this pot of gold. But then you fight against yourself to want something that you can't even see because you have faith in me, right? That's what makes it such a big deal. And then we're talking about basic needs and whether or not they are considered as materialism because we want to define where we're standing as a Muslim woman and whether it's in the direction of Allah's satisfaction.
And these days that we have the corona, Omicron, that is going on, and if you have a weak
immune system,
then you're gone.
Exactly.
So you really need to,
Nourish yourself.
Mm. One point that I wanted to share with you, I just had some instances of how some women were so selfless and so sincere at the time of the revolution. Because it was the anniversary of the
43rd, mashallah.
Anniversary of the
Islamic Revolution of Iran.
Yeah. And then I remembered, I actually, as a child, I have a very vivid memory in my mind.
Oh, good for
where
you.
The guys had gone to, for the 8-year
imposed war.
And I do remember women who would go to mosques or mm-hmm. who would go to each other's houses and they would make sweets or food. Or men's clothes for the soldiers.
The frontliners.
I actually remember the groups that they gathered together to do something selflessly. You could see sincerity in those days.
Totally.
One. And then, even after the revolution, there are so many camps, so many groups that join together to do something for free. Even we have some dentist friends that once or twice a year they all gather to go to like really far-fetched areas where like there's the poverty has have strict they fixed people's teeth for free. And these people I'm talking about, they're like super rich. But sometimes once in a while they just detach themselves from their money, from their comfort, from their wealth, and they go to like really
impoverished areas,
and they try to do this. It's actually, they're doing it for themselves, right? It's it's like that thing that you need to have once in a while to work on your nafs, to work on your soul, and to
it's
leash
like
it back.
It's spiritual food, really.
It's really necessary.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
And then one more thing that I wanted to share with you was that where does this sincerity come from? one thing that a government, a Muslim government, a Muslim society should expect from a woman is to have an educated woman.
That's like indisputable.
Exactly. So part of, I'm not talking about any kind of education, to become an engineer, a mine engineer, or to become like a, to study to be a firefighter, or to study to be an architect. I'm not talking about these kind of sciences, if that, if you study it or not, it's not really going to have that
much effect.
Make the
world a better place.
Exactly, as a woman, right? So I'm talking about knowledge that is either needed by you to become a better individual, or a knowledge that is needed for your society that you have to contribute as a very influential and successful woman in that society. Mm. Some things like to be a teacher, a nurse, a doctor, pediatrician, gynecologist, you know, things like that. University professor. But then comes the story of priorities in life and everything that we're not going to go into.
Yeah, we've already discussed this somewhere in one of our series. Yeah.
And to bring, some people might say that you guys are feminists and you're talking about like this because you're, you know, because of your own wishes and desires and it's just your words. I'm going to back up my idea from the Quran where it says, God will raise up those who have believed from among you and وَالَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعَلْمَ دَرَجَةً. And those of you who have been given knowledge, he's going to raise you in some degrees, in some levels. So knowledge is something that is really praiseworthy, that is considered valuable in the Islamic literature.
It's obligatory in Islam.
Exactly.
Whether you're a man or a woman.
And this is in chapter Mujadala, verse number 11. Or let me back up my idea by another verse from the Noble Quran. This is in chapter Tawbah. Mm. I love this verse so much. Verse number 122, which means that, and the believers should not all go out to fight.
Uh-huh.
Among you, of every troop of them, a party, and it doesn't say men and women, a party only should go forth, that they who are left behind may gain sound knowledge in religion. Sound knowledge in religion. And that they may warn their folk when they return to them. So among the type of knowledge that we have to acquire is tafaqquh fid din.
The do's and don'ts of religion.
Exactly. And the religion has so much to offer.
When you talk about do's and don'ts of religion, our minds quickly go to what nullifies salat, you know, the fiqhi aspect of it, whether it's haram or halal for a woman's ankles to show, can a man shave his beard, what time should we break our fast, what are the things that nullify our fast.
The ahkam.
The ahkam. We forget that Islam's do's and don'ts go beyond that. Islam tells us, don't lie, don't gossip, don't hurt someone's feelings, sure, don't trample upon their rights, don't disturb a bird while it's resting in its nest, don't fool an animal by pretending you have food in your hand to get
ethics.
It to come to you.
Ethics.
Islam tells us to be trustworthy, to be honest, to be loyal. Islam tells us not to break our promises. Islam tells us to be on time. There's a hadith from Rasulullah. His Eminence had an appointment with a random dude. Maybe it wasn't so random. Random for us 1400 years later. He had an appointment with the dude and he was standing where he said he'd be standing. And the sun was striking his face. And his companions came around and they were like, Ya Rasulullah, go stand in the shade. And Rasulullah was like, no, I told the man I'll be waiting for him over here.
Wow. Subhanallah.
This is Islam. You know what I mean?
You touched upon the ethics.
And it's the core of Islam.
Exactly. Which means?
I've been raised, I've been chosen as prophet to complete and perfect ethics.
You mentioned a really valuable point. We're not saying that the ahkam is not important. The sharia is definitely very important.
Yeah, exactly. But they go side by side, hand in hand.
Exactly. Islam always emphasizes the fact that it's a religion of balance.
Exactly.
And moderation.
Yeah.
Do not make a caricature, you know, do not make overemphasize or exaggerate one part of religion and then totally neglect the core, the heart, I mean, the veins of religion, which is ethics. And yeah, and more important than knowing the ethical points in Islam, acting upon them is definitely more important than just knowing them, right? And that is the part that where you have to work on your nafs and you have to like tame it. You have to bring it up in a way that it will be within your demand, within your control, right? This is the hardest part of life. We're among all the attractions, all the glitters, all the everything that is just trying to pull you away. Like, you are always in at a juncture when it comes to ethics, right? The right and the left, which one to choose? And based on how much you've worked on yourself and based on what your intention is and what your goal in life is, you decide whether the right or the left-hand side to select, yeah. Right? So far, we've mentioned 2 points out of the expectations that it stated that an Islamic state should have of women. Number one, we said sincerity and pure faith, which is common between men and women. The second one, which is also common among men and women, and sometimes throughout history, women have been, they have lacked behind or they have been deprived, is education, proper education. And by education, we mean one part of it is tafaqquhu fid-deen, you know, to become an expert in religion and not only the ahkam, but also the ethics.
Mm-hmm.
The third one, Zainab, I believe that one thing which is super, super important is that if you want everything to flow smoothly and if you want to have a proper, strong, well-established society, you need to have a well-established foundation, which is Ma buniya bana'un
family. No, I agree with you 100%.
Habbu Allah ta'ala min at-tazwij.
Yes, but sometimes
marriage, family.
But sometimes the thing is that a woman cannot have a happy marriage. Sometimes. Okay. A woman cannot have a happy marriage if she was the product of a broken marriage.
Okay.
I do not dispute with the importance, significance, trivial and irreplaceable role of family. But I'm just saying, honey, family goes back generations, not just the family I'm about to establish. Okay. And that's all the time we have for today's episode. There's so much more to talk about this. I agree with you entirely.
You brought a question that is so controversial.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, I left program. You guys at a cliff,
bye guys.
Cliffhanger, you know? So you'd be intrigued to join us again in further episodes.
Okay.
Not that our topics are not interesting
but
enough.
But remember your question, though.
Family is important, you guys. And fix past traumas before you get into new relationships. Because if you don't heal, you're going to end up bleeding on someone who didn't cut you.
Zainab, sometimes you don't even know that you're in a trauma until you start, you go to another relationship.
Yeah, of course, no.
That is the time that your traumas come up.
Yeah.
So
I totally agree.
You know,
I'm not saying
when
that
you're in your isolation, when you're just in, you know, you're just you and you in your alone island, you don't even realize that you have these
problems,
messed up personalities.
Yeah, for sure.
So you have to get it involved in a family and then fix it at the same time.
No. But the awareness
comes after you are in a relationship, unless you go to a psychologist.
Yeah, that's the awareness I'm
talking
about.
You don't even
know
you have to go to a psychologist.
No. You always have to go to a psychologist. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. Mm-hmm.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kip Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere that abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
We're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
And one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact. Trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. Everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns that have to pull out.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so. And everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat-eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
Also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean,
I really enjoyed it. Like you said about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyist as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. Mm-hmm. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous pit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already and the, you know, mm-hmm. activists against fossil fuels and things like this mm-hmm. as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the mm-hmm. agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on as we show the clips in regard to that part of the programme. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, this is as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but he does break it down in quite very obvious terms. He uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforest for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's freshwater, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kip Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. Mm. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak up and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on. But, I mean, when he talks, he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. Mm-hmm. Every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
Mm-hmm. It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, yeah. Which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely, and if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction, it's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and the inhumane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing. And it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not the term vegan is another matter. Mm-hmm. But they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
Mm. I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on the people in positions of power rather than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
I couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, as they say, you know, use less coal, ride your bike. What about, you know,
less need? Yeah. I think they focus grouped it, and it's a political loser. Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I had invited to a meeting with Al Gore some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushed back. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film. because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless.